compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back. I am going to go to your phone calls here in just a moment. First, though, I want you to hear some vintage Billy Graham. Billy Graham, when you, I wanted to set this up for you. There is a dispute. To me, it's a non-issue. But yet some people, they wrangle over it and they fight over it and they post mean comments on social media over it. And that is, what color was Jesus? What was his skin color? What was his ethnicity? Well, ethnically, he was Jewish from the Middle East, the land of Israel. And the land of Israel, of course, was a crossroads for many generations for migration and trade, armies, and other reasons people would transit through that area, east, west, north, and south. So it was a cosmopolitan area, and you had people from many lands there. Now, what color was Jesus' skin? We don't know. It's not been revealed to us. And we can turn to science and try to determine what did people look like. I quoted on this show, I don't know, a year or so ago, maybe, some scientific studies. This was an article that was carried in the Jerusalem Post about scientific studies demonstrating that in that general area of the land of Israel, not to mention further north into Lebanon and into Syria, that there was a significant number of people, scientists now know, at the time of Christ who had blue eyes. And what does that mean? Nothing really. Does it mean that Jesus had blue eyes? No. I mean, he could have. There were plenty of other people in the area, scientists now know, who had blue eyes. But ultimately, does it matter? Doesn't matter. And I want you to hear what Billy Graham has to say on this issue in light of all the people who even today are still wrangling and fuming and fretting and fighting over about what was Jesus' skin color and what did he look like. Here's what Billy Graham had to say.
And don't you black people ever forget one thing. The man that helped Jesus carry that cross was a black man. And don't ever forget another thing. Jesus belongs to Africa as much as he does to Europe and Asia. He was born in that part of the world that touches Africa and Asia and Europe. And Jesus was not a white man like me, nor was he as black as some of you. We don't know what the color of his skin, but it must have been a dark color like the people of his day, because he was a man like them. Don't ever say it's a white man's religion or a black man's religion. It's a world religion. He belongs to the world.
Wow. Good stuff. We need some more Billy Grahams. I'd like them to be Catholic Billy Grahams this time around, but boy was he good, and boy was he correct in what he said. 888-914-9149. Daniel in Victorville, welcome to the program.
Hey, Patrick. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I just have a basic question as far as if I'm excused from going to Mass on Sunday, based on my job. And I know the short answer is probably going to be, well, no. But
no, actually, the short answer is yes. The short answer is
yes. Oh,
yeah,
yes.
Yes, but there's an asterisk, but go ahead with your question.
So I do work for utilities. I work in the electrical industry, and I'm basically on the front line of emergencies or anything like that. And with my shift, I work 12-hour shifts, day and graves and stuff, and it rotates. I don't work a regular Monday through Friday. There are times when I'm working Saturdays and Sundays, and I do everything I can to make it to Sunday Mass or Saturday evening as I can. There would be occasions, though, where just with the hours or things that are going on, I'm unable to make Sunday Mass or Saturday evening. I've asked the priest about this, and he told me as long as I have made every attempt to go to Mass, that I'm okay, that I can go on Monday daily Mass if I'm able to make it, or watch it on live stream. But, you know, obviously I want to go to Mass in person since that's our obligation. But
right.
I just want to know how that lines up. I mean, I've read up in the Catechism, I think it's 2120, where if you're ill or whatever, then it won't be considered a mortal sin. So I just wanted to get your advice, and I appreciate that.
Sure thing. So you're in the category, a broader category of people like police officers, physicians, people in the military who, because their job requires them to work on Sundays sometimes, it's beyond their control.
Right.
They have no way to get to mass. So in a situation like that, you're not violating your Sunday obligation to go to mass. You just can't go. And so it would be in the same type of category as if you were sick or there was some other thing that came up that prevented you from going. So let's say that wasn't your job. Let's say that your wife is visiting her family in California. Well, you're in California. So she's visiting her family in Florida and you're at home and you've got a three-year-old baby who's sick with a fever and you can't leave that baby alone. Well, you can't go to mass with the baby and you can't go to mass by yourself because you have to take care of the baby. If you stay home and miss mass, you have a just cause for doing so. And the church knows that. So your job fits into that same category. Now, let's put it this way. Let's say that your job said, no, Daniel, you don't have to work on Sunday. If you do, we'll give you overtime and you'll make twice as much money. And you say, well, I guess I'll work overtime. I don't have to, but I will to make some extra money. And then you miss mass. That would be a sin because then it is within your control and you are putting the higher, you know, the bigger paycheck above worshiping God at mass. So something like that where it is in your control would be a problem, but sounds like what you're describing is not.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, and it's not overtime on these particular days. It's on my regular schedule.
Oh, no, I'm just using that as a scenario. Yeah, I was just throwing that
out.
Right. That's all.
Right. So, I mean, if I were to try and, like, get substitutions and people switching schedules, I feel like that'd be a kind of a hardship on the crew. Mm-hmm. So, but as long as it's just a regular day, then okay.
If I were you, I wouldn't want to prolong that indefinitely. So if you could have a conversation with your boss and say, I go to mass on Sunday as a Catholic and I just can't with the schedule, but I really want to. Can you figure out a way? Can I start, you know, at 10 or can I start a little bit later so I can get to mass first? There may be a creative workaround. And I think that would be very meritorious in God's eyes if you were to do what you can to try to make that happen. And if your hands are tied and you can't do it, well, at least you tried. But there may be some solutions.
Okay.
So.
Okay, cool.
All right.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Patrick. I appreciate that. I appreciate
you
and Cyrus and what you all do.
Thank you very much. You hear that, Cyrus? Thank you, Daniel. Let's go to Dennis now in Stillwater, Minnesota. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Patrick. Say, I got a question. I was on vacation last week in Michigan. And like you, I've heard you say before, you like to visit parishes when you're on vacation and and get to mass once or twice. Well, I did that. One was a weekday mass. One was a Sunday mass. And a couple things I noticed the priest did, one I think was just wrong and the other was just a little bit odd. Just a little note, the priest was elderly, so maybe that has something to do with some of this.
Okay.
But I'll mention both of these and I'd just like your thoughts on it. The first one was when he was offering the gifts. We've received the bread we've offered you, Lord, and we received the wine we've offered. You know, he had the host, and all the words seemed to be correct, but when he went to pour the wine into the cup, I didn't see any wine. All I saw was a vessel of water, which was what he poured in the cup, and I know it was water because it was then the same vessel he used to pour over his hands to wash his hands.
Was there another vessel of wine nearby? Was there another cruet or vessel of wine nearby?
Unless I was, you know, missed it, I didn't see it. But it wasn't on the altar. And if it was previously poured into the cup, you know, I suppose that could have been. But would that have been a normal? I've never seen that done before.
Yeah, let's park here for a minute. So a few things. It's possible that there was wine in the chalice that he did not pour in. That, you're right, that is very unusual, but it's not impossible that that could have happened. And if it did happen and he added the little drop of water to that wine, then of course there's no problem. If there was no wine at all and there was only water in the chalice, then that would be invalid. So there was no consecration there of the chalice if that were the case. Now, maybe in his old age, he's forgetful to the point where he just forgot. That's possible. It's hard to say why somebody might do that, because priests know that in order to validly consecrate, you have to have the wine and the unleavened bread. And without that, you don't have a valid mass. So without knowing anything, I would like to think that maybe he was either forgetful or there was wine in the chalice ahead of time. So I'd like to hope that those
were... Yeah, let's hope that was the case. Yeah.
But even if he was forgetful, you know, maybe it wasn't his fault due to his memory problem. If that's the case, it still would be an invalid consecration because the proper matter was missing.
Yeah. And the other thing was when he didn't elevate, behold, the Lamb of God. He just held the broken bread over the chalice, you know, as it was sitting on the altar. And I thought maybe that he was just, you know, had some joint issues or something, you know.
Yeah, it's always good to give the benefit of the doubt. So I'm glad that you're looking at it that way. Maybe he has, you know, difficulty raising his arms. People, you know, in old age especially, you start having issues like that. So it may well have been something just like that. But even if it weren't, even if he's completely able-bodied, that's not a requirement that he do that in order for the Mass to be valid. And in some cases, you'll see, even though the sacramentary says that at this point the priest genuflects, some priests don't genuflect. They bow, and maybe they have bad knees. But maybe for those who don't have bad knees or difficulty, they just don't want to genuflect and they bow instead. So I would say that kind of thing, if that's what it is, that's between him and God. You know, the rubrics indicate what should be done. Sometimes, you know, a priest might say, I'm not going to do that. So it's hard to know in this case, but I like giving him the benefit of the doubt and assuming that it might have been a health issue. But even if it weren't,
absolutely.
he didn't do anything that would injure or diminish the spiritual fruitfulness of the Mass.
Yeah. I was going to ask him directly these questions, but of course I never got a chance to. He went back into the sacristy, and of course I never got to see him. But just thought I'd bring these to your attention and see what you had to say about it, and I appreciate your input.
You got it, Dennis. Thank you very much. Always, if you can, give someone the benefit of the doubt. I like it when people do that for me. There are few feelings worse than being people assuming bad motives when you don't have bad motives. But it might look that way to somebody who doesn't really care what's really going on. So as Jesus said, do unto others. Let's go to Susan now in Helena, Montana. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I'd like to preface my question with a statement that this has nothing to do with the Immaculate Conception. I totally, of course, believe that that was divinely inspired and created and all of that.
And when you say Immaculate Conception, what are you referring to?
Mary being pregnant with Christ.
Why don't we start there? Because that's not the Immaculate Conception. The Immaculate Conception, the dogma of the Immaculate Conception, is that Mary was free from all sin from the moment of her conception in her mother's womb. And she was conceived in the ordinary way. Her mother and father enjoyed the marital embrace, and Our Lady was the result of that. But she was free from all sin from the moment of her conception. The Immaculate Conception, that title does not refer to the virgin birth, which is what I think you're thinking about how Jesus was conceived in the Blessed Virgin Mary by the Holy Spirit. I think that's what you're talking about.
Thank you for clearing that up for me.
Sure.
Okay, so this isn't about that, and I don't want the listeners to think I was making a sideways reference. Here's my question.
Okay.
If a child is conceived out of wedlock, but then the parents marry before the birth of the child, isn't that child still considered illegitimate?
Okay, the term illegitimate is a legal term in the secular world. So it's not, we have to understand the term in context. So yes, from a legal standpoint, the civil law would reckon that child who was born to a woman who was not married as illegitimate. And that has legal connotations.
I was trying to avoid the B word.
I understand. Fair enough. So yes, from a civil law standpoint, that would be a category that the child would be in, through no fault of his own, of course, that the law would consider this an illegitimate birth. But the church does not look at that with regard to, say, getting that baby baptized or And I'll give you another example. This is a more common scenario. In a marriage that is that ends in divorce, let's say the couple get married, they have five children, and 10 years later they get a divorce. And then there's an annulment granted for whatever reason. A common misconception, and this may not be yours, Susan, but many people commonly misunderstand, and they think that if the marriage is annulled, well, actually, marriages can't be annulled. A valid marriage can't be annulled. But if a declaration of nullity is granted by the church, which says that this marriage was null from the beginning, some people assume that means that, oh, then that means my children are illegitimate. That's not what it means. The children are legitimate because that's a legal category under civil law. And the church does not say that those children are illegitimate. Now, that may not be your question, but I think that's an important connected question to it.
Well, thank you so much for clearing up both of those issues for me.
You're welcome.
And that's I do pray for you.
Go ahead, Susan.
I do pray for you, and please pray for my fam.
I certainly will. Thank you. Let's go to Nellie in Miami. Hi, Nellie.
Hi, Patrick. This is my request. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
When Joseph St. Joseph passed away, was Jesus present at his burial?
Was Jesus present when St. Joseph passed away? Is that your question?
Yes.
Well, we're not told by divine revelation, so we have no exact information about that. But we can, I think, safely assume that he was, for this reason, that when we see Jesus beginning his public ministry at the wedding at Cana in John chapter 2, St. Joseph is not present. And we could presume that if he were alive and well, that he would have been there with the Blessed Virgin Mary and with Jesus. So his absence suggests that he had died by that point. Now, if you go back to the instance in Luke's gospel where Mary and Joseph are separated from Jesus when he's 12 years old, and they come back to Jerusalem where they had inadvertently left him, and they find him there teaching in the temple, we're told that then when they got Jesus back, then he went back to Nazareth with them, and there he lived under their authority. And so that seems pretty clearly to suggest that sometime between then and the wedding at Cana, when Jesus was about 30 years of age, that St. Joseph must have died. And since Jesus stayed there, we're told, in Nazareth with them, I can't imagine how Jesus would not have been present when St. Joseph died, if he died, for example, of an illness or something. Now, if he fell and hit his head and died on the spot, that would be something different, but I doubt that happened to St. Joseph. I'm pretty confident, based on that biblical evidence, that Mary and Jesus were right there with St. Joseph when he passed away. But we can't say with certitude, but I think we have a high degree of confidence that that's what happened.
I pray for you every day, and thank you for your excellent program.
Thank you, Nellie. The feeling is warmly reciprocated. Thank you. Okay, timeout time, and then more of your phone calls and a few more updates on things going on in the world. You don't want to miss those. I'll be right back with that right after this.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Three Dog Night. That's an interesting choice of music. By the way, Cyrus, somebody got mad at me. They wrote me in a nasty gram, a listener, because I got the car mixed up from Dukes of Hazzard. And what did I say? I said a duster or something like that.
I don't remember.
I don't either. But that was enough to get somebody angry.
But it's really important.
It's super important. Well, another group of people are angry, and these are Italian Americans who are outraged, according to the New York Post, that Governor Andrew Cuomo, who is not long for office, he'll be gone in a few days. Governor Andrew Cuomo appeared to try to write off his strange and repulsive behavior with women as, quote, cultural behavioral differences. Adeline Sessa, whose family owns Ferrara Bakery and Cafe in Little Italy, said the Italian culture in general gets so many bad reps that are so untrue. This has nothing to do with being Italian. It's the man who he is. We Italians refuse to acknowledge Cuomo as a member of La Famiglia. One Twitter user said, Cuomo, who resigned Tuesday in the wake of an official investigation that concluded that he sexually harassed at least 11 women, was blasted for trying to reframe allegations of unwanted kissing and groping against him as a misunderstanding. That's all it is, just a misunderstanding, because he's an Italian-American. James Barry, who is the co-owner of a restaurant in Little Italy, Benito One, says, we're very affectionate people. When we do kiss, we kiss family, we kiss good friends. The only difference is, and then he says something that he doesn't do, that Governor Cuomo allegedly did a number of times. Frank Palmari, 56, who lives in Chelsea on a green card from Italy, he agreed, there's no way you do things like that. Because you're Italian doesn't mean you could just touch or kiss women the way you wanted. What about if it was his own daughter? Would you like that to happen to your daughter? So, I mean, it goes on and on, but people are incensed that Governor Cuomo would blame these misdeeds, or the alleged misdeeds that he denies happened, on his Italian heritage. So I don't know how you feel about that if you're Italian, but those Italian folk are riled about that. Let's go to Dominique in Phoenix. Hi, Dominique. Welcome.
Good morning. I have a question. I work at a Catholic school in Phoenix, and they've just banned communion on the tongue. And I know it's not a sin to receive in the hand, but mm-hmm. I don't feel okay doing that for many reasons. And I guess people are uncomfortable that some of us receive on the tongue. So my question for you is, what would you do? Would you not go up? Would you just kneel and try and receive on the tongue? What would you mm-hmm. recommend?
Yeah. So we talked about this a fair number of times last year, especially when COVID was at its height and some of these I regard to be exaggerated precautions were in place. But in any case, I offered three ways of handling that situation. The first was to make an act of mortification and say to the Lord, Lord, you know that I would prefer to receive you in Holy Communion on the tongue, but it's not possible for me to do so, and I want to receive you, so I'm going to receive you in the hand as much as I don't want to, and you know my heart, Lord. That's one option. You can do that. Another option would be to refrain from receiving communion if you are concerned about receiving it in the hand, and just refrain from receiving communion. But when I offer that bit of advice, please don't think that I'm encouraging people not to receive communion. I'm just saying that would be another option available to you. You're not obliged to receive Holy Communion at every Mass. I mean, we are obliged to receive Holy Communion at least once per year during the Easter season, but that would be another option. And then a third option would be to look for a parish where that restriction is not in place. So maybe a fraternity of the priestly fraternity of St. Peter, for example, or the Institute of Christ the King, or the traditional Latin Mass that's celebrated in the diocese. Those are places where you could go and be assured you wouldn't have to receive Holy Communion in the hand. So it seems to me those three options are, any one of which would be viable. I would not, you know, I would not encourage is the wrong word. I would never say to any Catholic to disobey your bishop, because the bishop has the authority to implement guidelines in his diocese. Now, it's entirely possible that the bishop might look back at it later and say, you know, that was a mistake. Pastorally speaking, that wasn't the right thing to do. But he has the competence and the authority to make decisions. That's his job. So I encourage obedience to the bishop. And if there are avenues of complying with the bishop that these three examples would fall into, then that's what I would propose. What do you think?
Yes. Yeah, I think those are great options. We're blessed here in Phoenix. We have a great bishop, mm-hmm. Bishop Olmsted, and he is okay with us receiving on the tongue. It's just the school that unfortunately has banned it now. But I've seen some wonderful videos of very reverent, holy people that kneel down regardless and try to receive on the tongue. And if they're denied, then they're denied. Mm-hmm. But these are all options to think about. Mm-hmm. And I think Jesus would be so proud of us for trying.
I think so too. I mean, I don't look down on anyone who receives Holy Communion on the hand. I don't. I never have. Well, I shouldn't say that. There maybe was a time or two when I was surprised by the priest putting the host into my hand when I was young and didn't quite know what to do at the time. But as a general rule, I don't. And that's how we raised our children, to receive Holy Communion on the tongue. But they're adults now, and so people can do it how they wish. The church permits it. That's the key thing. The church permits it. So I don't look down on anyone who does that, but my preference is to receive Holy Communion on the tongue. For me, it's more reverent. I think it's, for me, a better way to do it. But I have no authority to tell anyone else anything other than what the church says. Now, one interesting thing, Dominique, until just recently, when a response to a dubium came back from the Vatican, from the congregation, I think for divine worship, the question that was asked is, are bishops permitted to, in essence, suspend universal law? And the universal law in the church has always been, and we're talking about the Latin Rite Church, has always been that you have a right to receive Holy Communion on the tongue, and you cannot be deprived of that right. And that's explicitly stated in numerous authoritative documents. Nonetheless, some bishops decided that they wanted to, I guess you might say, negate that law and implement a restriction in their own diocese. So there was a controversy about that. Is that permissible? Can bishops do that? And a dubium was sent to the Vatican, to this congregation, and the response came back saying yes. So I think that's where the situation rests now. There's not much more than I can say about it. Prior to that response, I think we had a leg to stand on by pointing out that the universal law of the church was very explicit, that even during times of plague, Catholics still had the right to receive Holy Communion on the tongue. But that seems to have changed. So that's another little tidbit as part of this bigger picture. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. We'll go to Jim now in Paris, California. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I wanted to ask, do you think Catholicism has failed the Mexican population? When I think of everything you can criticize Catholicism for, it can be summarized and demonstrated through the examples of what you would find within the Hispanic community. I'm talking about lukewarm tradition of, you know, carrying on Catholic practices without actually practicing the faith at all. I'm talking about idolatry and all types of weird sorcerous crap mixed in with the faith, even outside my own church.
Jimmy, did you say adultery or idolatry?
Idolatry, yeah, sorry.
Idolatry, okay. That up. So your question to me is, has the Catholic Church failed Hispanic? I presume you're talking about Hispanic Americans here in the U.S. Is that your question?
No, across the board, just in Latin
Around
America,
the world?
Probably
okay.
more so, but also here in America, yes.
Well, it depends on how you mean failed. That, I think, is the word that I would have to think about. Have individual priests and even bishops failed their flock? Sure, that happens. But for every priest that does that, I would guess there are probably 10 who do a wonderful job of teaching the faith and providing the sacraments and being good shepherds to their flock. I mean, I know many such priests, and I've been to their parishes, and I've seen how vibrant and on fire the people are for the Lord. So I know that that is an example where they're not being failed, they're being fed. But I have seen the other as well. So I'd say it's a mixed bag, and it would depend on a given situation and a given location. I don't think it would be fair or even accurate to say, as a general rule, that the Catholic Church has failed Hispanics wherever they may be. And to the extent that the church is failing in some regard, then I would say this is true regardless of your ethnic background. It would be maybe the same in Sweden, you know, if we're talking about a laxity of the faith, or Germany or some other place. So it's hard for me to answer your question, at least not the way you're framing it.
Fairly stated. I completely, those are well points taken, and Protestantism has its own, you know, things they're guilty of here in America as well. So I appreciate your point. One final thought, if I may, just take a second. As a father, you know, sometimes the burden of life gets to me, and I have to ask, as a family man yourself throughout the past, when you were in the thick of it, you know, probably maybe a small fight with the missus, six kids climbing over you, did you ever look to the stars at night and think to yourself, you know, I'd trade it all just to sit around and drink beer and watch Maury all day on TV? Like, do you ever have those moments?
Well, I prefer red wine to beer, and I've never watched Maury Povich, although I do know who he is. But I think I get your question. Were there moments of angst and frustration and I'd rather be someplace else than here along the way? Yeah. And I'm quite sure that Nancy had those feelings from time to time as well. But I'm so glad I never gave in to any of those passing thoughts because I love her with all my heart and I'm grateful to God for the years that we've had together. I hope we have many more happy years together. So in retrospect, those fleeting moments of frustration, there weren't even blips on the radar screen, even if they might have been bugging me in the moment. You know what I mean?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Jim. I went out with a girl who graduated from Paris High School. Not that that matters, but that's my little connection to Paris, California. And that, of course, was before I met and started going out with Nancy. Now, interesting question that Jim raised, and I want to just refer to an article here in Catholic World Report. At least a quarter of Hispanics have left the Catholic Church, and of those, nearly half are now unaffiliated when it comes to religion. I want to share with you just a little bit about this because it gets into some statistics that I find alarming, quite frankly. So it begins with an anecdote. Vicente de Real, a Catholic from Chicago, was recently helping to facilitate a young adult gathering at his parish. The pastor walked in and said to one of the attendees that he should go to the seminary. The young adult said to him, "Father, do you know my name?" The priest went red and admitted that he didn't. So the young man says, "Well, what do you know about what is good for me if you don't even know my name?" Del Real said the story illustrates for him a problem that he's experienced in the Catholic Church in the U.S. He worries that as he sees it, there's too much talk out there about truly getting to know and ministering to young people, Latinos in particular, and not enough actually doing it. He says, "I wish that we did less talking in the church about working with young people in general and more actually working with people in general. I think we often talk about how do we engage young people? How do we give them leadership? How do we empower them? I think we also need to give them agency. We need to give us space for us to exercise leadership." He's 31. He was born and raised in Mexico. He came to the U.S. when he was 15. Although he says he remains strong in the Catholic faith that he received from his parents, statistics suggest that many of his peers are moving away from a strong practice of the Catholic faith. So here are some statistics. According to a 2014 Pew Research survey, at least a quarter of U.S. Hispanics have left the Catholic Church, and of those, nearly half are now unaffiliated when it comes to religion. Now, that's 7 years ago. Other Pew studies suggest that only 16% of U.S. Hispanics say being Catholic is an essential part of their Hispanic identity. It's undeniable that the Catholic Church in the U.S. and the U.S. in general is becoming more and more Latino. Statistics from the Pew Research Center suggest that it's possible that in the not-too-distant future, a majority of U.S. Catholics will be Hispanic, even though the majority of Hispanics will likely no longer be Catholic. That's the money quote in this article. Listen to that again. Statistics from Pew suggest that it's possible that in the not-too-distant future, I think it's likely not possible, that in the not-too-distant future, a majority of U.S. Catholics will be Hispanic, even though the majority of Hispanics will no longer be Catholic. You really should read this article because it cuts to the bone in terms of what's going on and, quite frankly, some of the stuff that's not going on that could and should be going on to help Hispanic Catholics retain their Catholic identity. Now, this is not anything new. We've seen this before. We've seen where a culture and people with strong religious convictions, they assimilate into a secular country. And they very quickly, in a generation or two, they lose their religious identity. So assimilation is a sociological, anthropological dimension of all this. And this is not unique to Hispanics. But since we're talking about Hispanics here in the United States, and I know from personal experience what this is like. Just a quick aside, because we have to take a break in a minute or so. But as you know, I've mentioned this to you before. I'm half Hispanic. My father's family, 100%. Hispanic from Mexico, and then before that from Spain. And so, like, my grandparents are from Mexico. They're dead now. May they rest in peace. My dad was just barely born across the border in El Paso, Texas, because during the time of the Mexican Revolution, Pancho Villa and all those guys, my father's family had to flee on his mother's side. They had to flee from Mexico. They were from the Chihuahua area. and they had to get out because they were being killed off because they were siding with the federal government and Porfirio Diaz and all that. So they had to leave, and they came across the border legally, and they came to El Paso and settled there. My dad was born there. He would have been born in Mexico had it not been for that. So I see in my own family, I mean, I've got cousins, and I'm talking about now my aunts and uncles, all of whom, like my dad, grew up speaking Spanish. My dad didn't learn English until he got into like first grade. I don't know if he went to kindergarten. Maybe he did. I should ask him. But he used to tell us, he said, I didn't know English until I got into, say, first grade. And we all spoke Spanish. So they were Mexicans from Mexico living in the U.S. They had their Mexican identity. And that's how my father grew up. And my aunts and uncles raised my cousins very much the same way as my parents raised us. And I can count on, I don't know, one finger, maybe two, out of all my cousins. And we're talking about a lot of cousins. Maybe one or two are still Catholic. So I know from personal experience what it means to be Hispanic and to have that cultural connection and the identity as a Catholic from the old country, whatever that may mean. And for different people, it means different things, but it was still a very strong, cohesive force and had been for many generations until fairly recently. So I don't see any question at all but that Hispanic people are basically assimilating and they're leaving the church. They're becoming secularized. This is true of other groups, but it just happens to be the group we're talking about it now. So if you're interested in that article from Catholic World Report, it has much more detail and it's got the statistics and you can take a look at it. We'll post that for you on the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show, or just go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick, and you can grab it there along with everything else that we post for you. Quick timeout. I'll be right back right after this. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right. Let's go to Vincent in East Rutherford, New Jersey. Hi, Vincent.
Hello, Patrick. I want to make witness to something important. I was listening to what you were saying in the last hour about the virus. I have the Divine Mercy picture on my front door since the time the pandemic started. I forget the priest's name who had done it, comparing it to the Jews putting the blood over the lintel in the doorway in the Passover. And when I did that, I went outside and I said some prayers to St. Michael, blessed the house with holy water outside. And I'm telling you, I believe from that day to this, I was able to keep the virus out of my house with the Divine Mercy image. And that's everybody great. I sell this to looks at me like I'm a weirdo, but I firmly believe that that's the reason why, because we'd have my son's girlfriend over, my girlfriend over, other people have come over to do work in the house. Mm-hmm. We've all gone to work and come home, had contact with other people, and thank God have been healthy. And I truly believe that that Divine Mercy image has kept us healthy.
That's great. Who am I to argue?
I just wanted to share that.
No, that's good. I mean, we've seen instances of such things happening before. You may remember that when the Israelites were wandering in the desert for 40 years, one of the afflictions was poisonous serpents biting them and killing them. And so God commanded Moses to fashion a statue, an image of a snake, a bronze serpent mounted on a pole, and that whoever would look at that image would be healed miraculously. So it's not as though, you know, that kind of thing couldn't happen. Now, you know, if you come down with COVID next week, then you may have to rethink your idea on this issue. But far be it from me to say that it couldn't happen. It certainly could be the case.
Okay.
All right. I'm glad you called today, Vincent. Thank you. Okay, now we have some more calls we're going to get to, but first I want to get to some more of the audio clips that I promised you. So let's go first to, we talked a little bit about the vaccine. Governor Newsom was talking about the vaccine mandate for teachers and school staff. Cyrus, I think we have some audio of, well, why don't we do these audios first? Okay, so this next one comes from KTLA, and this is as of yesterday afternoon, reporting on how things are tightening up with regard to the need for vaccines or proof of a vaccine for things like going to restaurants and such. Let's play that one next.
The LA City Council has voted to direct the city attorney to draft an ordinance requiring proof of COVID-19 vaccinations indoors at gyms, restaurants, and other spaces. This comes as the LA County Board of Supervisors has voted to look into how to possibly implement proof of vaccination procedures for certain indoor areas as well. Now, the board is directing county officials to come up with possible options and then report back in 2 weeks. The report is expected to detail what kind of indoor spaces should require people to show proof of vaccination, how people should present that, and whether a mandate should require one dose or full vaccination. Supervisor Janice Hahn says her goal in this possible mandate would be to avoid another round of business lockdowns.
All right, so that's courtesy of KTLA. Now you're going to hear about the problem. As you might imagine, people get creative. Two clips, they're both brief, talking about people who are faking these vaccination cards. You can buy these things on the black market. So this next one is courtesy of NBC4 talking about this phenomenon of people getting fake vaccination cards.
More and more employers, restaurants, and businesses in Southern California are now requiring that you show proof that you've gotten a COVID vaccination before they're going to let you in. Public health experts say requiring that proof could stem the rise in COVID cases.
But the iTeam's Jill Grover is learning now some people who don't want to get vaccinated at all are now obtaining fake vaccination cards. The state's top law enforcement official tells the iTeam, if you use a counterfeit card, you could go to jail.
At one of LA's most legendary restaurants, Langer's Deli, you now have to show proof of vaccination to get inside. Patrons entering the Abbey Bar in West Hollywood are also required to show vaccine cards. And so will all ticket holders at the Pantages Theater when the hit musical Hamilton opens next week. But the iTeam has learned some unvaccinated people are trying to skirt these rules.
Someone you know told you they're using a phony vaccination card.
I was angry.
Sandra Hansen is a Southern California nurse working with cancer patients. She says people are telling her they're using fake cards.
I don't know why people would feel the need to be dishonest that way.
Cybersecurity experts say counterfeit vaccination cards are now available for purchase, including on the internet. Last month, Dr. Julie Mazzi, a licensed naturopathic doctor in Napa, was arrested and charged by the feds, who alleged that she falsified, fabricated, and altered immunization cards and instructed people to mark the cards to falsely state that they had received the Moderna vaccine.
If I showed you a vaccination card, could you always tell if it's real or fake?
The reality is I probably couldn't tell.
Mark Ostrowski is a nationally known cybersecurity expert.
They're very easy to duplicate because they're paper cards.
He says the government should add elements to vaccination cards like we have on passports and driver's licenses that make them harder to counterfeit.
There needs to be an advancement into digital passports with back-end validation, unique identifiers.
States like New York and now California are launching digital COVID-19 vaccination records and apps to try and verify proof of vaccination. But there are still bugs to be worked out.
This is a crime. There is a risk of criminal prosecution.
California attorney.
All right, you get the idea. Okay, so the last one we're going to hear, this is the FBI talking about, well, it's not the FBI themselves, but courtesy of NBC in the Bay Area talking about how the FBI is all over this. So let's not forget, you know, thou shalt not bear false witness. This is a form of lying. It is immoral to do that. And I know people, they say, well, I don't want to get it, but I don't want to stop going to restaurants. So some people are resorting to this, and this is wrong. So don't do it. And here's some information about the FBI saying why you shouldn't do it, too.
You probably know this, more and more companies, concert halls, stadiums, and now even colleges will be asking for that vaccine passport to get in. That quest for that vaccine card has led to a lot of crooks selling fake cards online. Be careful here. Our business and tech reporter, Scott Budman, has the story.
Well, one of the reasons you see so many fake cards online is they're really easy to make. After all, there's not much of a difference between that and this.
And now that you need a negative COVID test or proof of vaccination to get into events like Giants games, the card is cool, and that's the kind of thing that fuels the market for fakes.
These are dangerous. These are wrong.
California's new Attorney General Rob Bonta, along with attorneys general from 38 other states, recently sent letters to eBay, Twitter, Shopify, and other websites, sounding the alarm and asking the sites to remove fraudulent card ads immediately.
If someone has a vaccine card, it needs to be accurate. So the message is stop immediately, cease and desist, do not engage in these practices. Lives and health depend on it.
The FBI is also getting involved, saying those buying or selling a fake card could face federal charges up to 5 years in prison.
The problem with this whole thing is that there's not a lot of uniformity with the cards. And so maybe even finding whether a card is fake or not will be a really hard task for these social media companies to do.
All the more reason to just get the shot and the real proof, both for your legal and medical protection.
You can fool the authorities, but you can't fool the virus. The virus knows whether you've been vaccinated or not.
Scott Budman, NBC Bay Area News.
Oh, the virus doesn't know anything. The virus is a virus, but I get his point. So just another word of advice. Don't traffic in these fake COVID-19 vaccination cards, because sooner or later, that's going to bite you. Now, I want to take a walk down memory lane here. And you may remember, if you're listening to this program a year ago, even more than a year ago. So here we are in August. So even in like April, May of last year, I was theorizing. This is before there even were any vaccines. They weren't even available yet. And we just didn't know. We didn't know what was going to happen. Which way is this going to go? And is it possible that maybe there would be a need for, well, let me ask you this question, Cyrus. Do we have time for this audio, or should we play it when we come back? Maybe we should play it when we come back.
All right. Yeah, this is great. I mean, this is from a year ago.
From a year ago,
and
yeah.
You're talking about all of the stuff that's happening right now. I thought you were crazy.
I remember when you told me that.
Well, you know what? At this point, I would turn into a believer, because it was before this. Before COVID was even a thing, you were warning. I don't even know if it was on the air or not, but you were telling me behind the scenes, like, this is big, Cyrus. I'm like, no, man, this is just another bird flu. This is nothing. They're just trying. This is fear mongering. And then it got worse and worse. And everything you said, don't record this. Everything you said was right. And so, by the time you got to what we're going to share with everybody on the other side of the break here, I was a believer, and I was starting to worry a little bit.
Yeah, well, thanks. And you know, I wish I weren't right about it, but as I remember, as we were thinking this through, and we did a lot of that on the program in the late spring and into the summer of last year. And again, this is before there were any vaccines, before any of these things were a reality. All we knew was that your parish was closed, and you had to wear a mask, and you're supposed to stay indoors and socially distance and flatten the curve and all of those things that we were hearing. But there were no real timelines. There was no real answer. But I recall even then, when we were kind of thinking out loud about this and trying to game it out, where could this possibly go? This issue of being able to forge rather easily the cards that would verify. So like, if there ever is a vaccine, how are they going to know if you've been vaccinated? Well, you could have a card, but what if you lose the card? What about people who forge the card? So, you know, those were all considerations, but it was pure speculation. And now we're seeing these things happen. And it's just weird, isn't it, when you think about a year ago?
It's crazy. Yeah, I was looking for some audio this morning. And so I went way back, and I was in the first week of the pandemic, and you were asking Kaylin and I, it's like, have you guys been to a grocery store? you know? And we're like, well, nope, it's been a couple weeks. And you're like, they're pretty soon they're going to start putting up all this. When the next time you go in, there's going to be plexiglass. And it was really bizarre thinking back before that, you know, when,
yeah,
how things used to be, and yeah, how much they've changed.
Ain't it the truth? So what we'll do then, so, and thanks for looking for that stuff, Cyrus. What we'll do then is we're going to take a break here in just a few seconds. We'll come back and we'll just listen to what we were talking about then, early last year and beyond, and what some of these speculations amounted to. And I don't want to do this to say, hey, you know, I told you so, but rather, isn't it interesting to see how, for example, talk about vaccine passports. And what if you lose the passport? Should it be digital? Should it be on your phone? Or what if you leave your phone at home? What's next? What are some other options? And we'll get into those things and your phone calls on the other side of this quick timeout. The number to call, 888-914-9149. We'll be right back with Hour 3 right after this.